This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, September 9th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Texas Senate Bill 8, known as the Texas Heartbeat Act, was signed into law by Governor Greg Abbott in May. The bill allows private citizens in Texas to sue anyone who aids in an abortion after a fetal heartbeat is detected. The law effectively outlaws the vast majority of abortions in Texas, but its supporters argue that it does not violate the precedent set by Roe v. Wade, because private citizens, not the state, are enforcing the ban. Last week, as the bill was set to go into effect, many thought that the Supreme Court might block the law. But in a midnight ruling, the court refused to intercede. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, one of the four dissenters, wrote in her opinion that SB 8, as she put it, is a flagrantly unconstitutional law engineered to prohibit women from exercising their constitutional rights and evade judicial scrutiny. At a press conference in Austin last week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi promised legislation protecting women's rights to reproductive care.
Well, the Supreme Court making the decision that it did not only disrespected women, it disrespected the Supreme Court and its former decision, its precedent that it had established as Roe v. Wade. When we go back to Washington, we will be putting Roe v. Wade codification on the floor of the House.
Margaret Talbot, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss the Texas bill and the future of abortion rights. Margaret, welcome.
Thank you, Dorothy. I'm glad to be here.
Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973, and in the decades since, we've seen many, many attempts by state legislatures around the country to block women's access to abortion, including some laws written specifically to challenge Roe. So what makes this Texas law different?
Well, you're right. The anti-abortion movement has actually been very inventive and indefatigable in coming up with all kinds of laws to place restrictions on abortion rights, from parental consent laws to obligatory waiting periods and obligatory counseling, obligatory ultrasound, mandatory ultrasound, medically unnecessary ultrasound before abortions, and so on. And this one is really different because, as you say, it essentially deputizes private citizens to enforce this abortion ban, which takes effect at 6 weeks, which is a period, as many people have noted, a point in pregnancy when many people do not even realize they are pregnant yet. And this asks private citizens to sue, and they can sue anyone who is aiding and abetting a woman seeking an abortion. So that could be, of course, a doctor or a staff at a clinic, but it could also be, as has people have pointed out, you know, an Uber or Lyft driver driving somebody to an abortion clinic. So this is new, and this is a way to kind of confound the playbook of the pro-choice legal side, because, you know, generally what you do when you're bringing a lawsuit alleging that a law is unconstitutional is you sue state officials. And this is requiring a whole different strategy and a whole different approach when you're dealing with potentially multitudes of private citizens trying to stand in the way of women exercising their constitutional right to abortion.
It's also worth pointing out that it's part of the court's shadow docket, which is pretty shocking given the ramifications that this law could have. But even apart from those ramifications for access to abortions, the Texas law is pretty radical. Justice Sotomayor pointed out that it's unconstitutional for a state to deputize citizens to carry out a law that violates the right to privacy.
Yes, that's right. You know, and you kind of think about the implications of a law like this. You know, if Democrats were to take this approach up, the statutory approach up, and, you know, pass gun control laws that deputize private citizens to go seize the guns of their neighbors, or, you know, vaccine mandate or mask mandate laws that deputize private citizens, you know, I think it's a kind of a world and a kind of regime. And when you think about the implications of it, it's disturbing. disturbing, and not a world that most of us would want to live in.
All this said, the bill is ingenious in its own sort of perfidious way. Do we know where it came from and how the idea was hatched?
Yeah, well, there was actually an interesting article in Texas Monthly by the journalist Mimi Swartz pointing out that there was a kind of mastermind behind this bill. And that was interesting because it is such a new approach. And he is a guy named Jonathan Franklin Mitchell, apparently, who is a 45-year-old guy, very well legally educated at the University of Chicago and other places, and a former Solicitor General of Texas. And, you know, his sort of specialty is coming up with laws that can be well insulated against legal challenges. And so he came up with this idea. And it's interesting because other states now, Florida among them, have, indicated that they are now considering similar laws, taking this private citizen approach.
Let's jump back to Roe v. Wade for a second, which is, of course, the bulwark for abortion rights in this country for almost 50 years. So that case centered on Norma McCorvey, who was identified by the pseudonym Jane Roe, who was pregnant with her third child and wanted an abortion in Texas. You wrote recently for the magazine about a new book about McCorvey and her family. Could you tell us a little bit about her role at the center of that case?
Yeah, she's an interesting person because, as the journalist Joshua Prager writes in his forthcoming book that I write about, it's called The Family Row, she is somebody who was kind of exploited by both sides in the abortion wars, in the sense that she for a while was kind of as she came out from behind her pseudonym, she became sort of an asset to the pro-choice side and a speaker, but it was never all that comfortable with some of the feminists who kind of took her aboard in the movement. So then she at a certain point in her life became born again, was kind of taken up by particularly this guy Flip Benham, who is the head of Operation Rescue, the militant anti-abortion group. As somebody said, somebody on the anti-abortion side, the poster child has fallen off the poster. So she became very useful to the anti-abortion side. And they painted her as someone who was just consumed with regret over abortion. Ironically, she never actually got an abortion. It was too late for her. Her child was born by the time the Supreme Court heard the case in 1973. And then at the end of her life, she kind of flipped a little bit again and appeared in a documentary towards the end of her life called AKA Jane Roe, where she basically said she believed in abortion rights with some restrictions and had kind of been drawn into the anti-abortion movement because they were nice to her and she was kind of bored in her life at that time. And she was not a very, ideologically committed person. That wasn't the way she rolled.
And the ruling itself was really fraught from the start. It stipulated that this right to privacy is not absolute. And even the concurring justices disagreed about whether the right to privacy was the relevant factor in McCorvey's right to have an abortion. So it doesn't seem like the firmest foundation on which to build a whole reproductive rights movement.
Yeah, people have had that critique of the decision over the years. And the decision written by Harry Blackmun was really focused on the right to privacy, the right to, areas of intimate life that the state would not encroach upon. And that had been the basis or part of the basis for an earlier decision, Griswold v. Connecticut, which gave married people the right to use contraception, essentially to obtain contraception. But yes, I think people have said over the years, including, interestingly, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was, of course, a very strong supporter of abortion rights, but really thought that privacy and the sort of focus of the decision in Roe on a woman's relationship with her doctor kind of overlooked larger arguments about equality and what might be called reproductive justice, sort of a more expansive view where you're talking about women's rights not only to have an abortion or to postpone childbearing or prevent childbearing, rather, but also to have lives where they could easily have children children and have, for example, rights to child care. But yes, I think for Ginsburg, it was really a matter of equality. It was a matter of women having the right to control their destiny, right to, you know, have professional lives, have public lives that, you know, really is limited by not having control over your reproduction.
There were also laws supporting abortion before Roe. In 1973, several states protected abortion rights, and similar laws were moving through legislatures in other states. So it's been argued that a slower legislative process like that might have been preferable to a Supreme Court decision that changed abortion laws nationwide. That's kind of a version of what Ginsburg was saying. What do you make of that argument?
Yeah, that's a really interesting argument, and it's definitely one that Ginsburg believed in. She thought that Roe v. Wade was precipitous and that there should have been time allowed for the political process to work and for state legislatures to gradually consider and most likely legalize abortion, you know, state by state. And that's there was really a kind of a consensus about that with Roe. That was really part of what created this long-lasting battle over abortion that we are still living through. Was this kind of leap to the judicial solution at the Supreme Court level. But there's, you know, there's debate about that. There's Linda Greenhouse, who was the longtime New York Times Supreme Court correspondent, and Reva Siegel, who's a law professor at Yale, have actually looked into this claim. And they think actually, you know, even though there was widespread public support for abortion rights on the eve of Roe, that state-by-state effort had kind of stalled out. And it was partly stalling out because there was a very well-organized, at that time, movement against abortion. You know, so they argue that actually this narrative in which we would have gotten abortion rights, which most Americans wanted, you know, through this gradual state-by-state process is probably not entirely right. And that also there's nothing particularly unique about a judicial decision in spurring a backlash, that if this had been passed by federal legislation, there would have been a backlash too, because abortion is, you know, controversial for various reasons and because evangelicals really organized around it.
A couple decades after Roe, there was another important Supreme Court ruling on abortion rights, Planned Parenthood v. Casey. How did that decision affect the precedent set by Roe?
Right. That was in 1992. And it was kind of a, give with one hand, take away with the other. It did reaffirm the a woman's constitutional right to abortion before fetal viability, which is usually considered about 24 weeks. But it established this new standard that allowed states to put restrictions on access to abortion, including in the first trimester. And that was this undue burden standard. It was this kind of balancing test that basically the idea was you could put restrictions on access to abortion as long as they didn't impose a so-called undue burden on women seeking them. But of course, that's a pretty subjective standard, what constitutes an undue burden. You know, how far do you have to travel to another state, you know, to get an abortion? You know, is a waiting period something that's really going to be disruptive for some women who have to take time off of work, or, you know, don't have the support at home. So anyway, that's been the standard that the court has been working with in cases since.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
We should emphasize that last week the court did not rule on the legal merits of SB 8. It refused to intercede on procedural grounds. But the ruling did follow, sort of unsurprisingly, largely ideological grounds. The only conservative to dissent was Chief Justice Roberts an opponent of abortion, and that move may well have been, probably was tactical. What can we see in the conservative majority's current approach to abortion rights based on this current ruling?
Well, I think you see the impact in very raw and undeniable terms of the loss of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So you now have a court where you may occasionally get Roberts to vote with the liberals on, for example, an abortion case where it seems like an egregious either flouting of kind of court precedent or something that looks suspect to somebody who's as much of an institutionalist and so concerned with kind of how the court looks that it not be too not appear to be too politicized. So, you know, occasionally he will vote with the liberals on those grounds, but of course that's still only a 4-person block, so they're always going to lose these abortion cases. You know, they have a case coming up in the fall, which involves a Mississippi law that basically bans abortions at 15 weeks. And that has been widely regarded as the case that could overturn Roe. And, you know, the court would not have had to have taken this case. It could have continued to try and punt on these cases, but it did take it on because there are people, the conservatives on the court are very eager to. And, you know, in some cases, like in the case of Clarence Thomas, have actually specifically said they are, you know, looking to overturn Roe.
So let's say that the Texas law is allowed to stand or that the court decides to overturn Roe. Where does that leave the fight for abortion rights?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, I think one thing that's happened is that in blue states in the last several years, about 15 states, including states, you know, large states, California, New York, Illinois, have passed laws shoring up abortion rights in their state. So either reaffirming in their state constitutions a woman's right to abortion or requiring private and public insurance to cover abortion in their states or allowing nurse practitioners or physician's assistants to perform them. So just basically trying to expand access and affirm the right to abortion within their state. So in a world in which Roe was overturned, you know, some women in states that had not done this could make their way, if they had the resources, to these states that would become essentially abortion refuges. You know, one thing that's, of course, very different about the world now than in 1973 is that there's medication abortion now, which, you know, the FDA first approved in 2000 and has been used by almost 3 million women in the United States.
That's the abortion pill.
The abortion pill, right, which is usually 2 pills, mifepristone and misoprostol. But as I say, it's been used by almost 3 million women in the United States. It has a very good safety record. And there are many groups now that help people purchase these online and that try and vet their safety and provide advice from doctors. So that is something that a lot of groups are preparing for. They're preparing for this world in which they may be doing that more. And there are also local municipalities and states that are offering abortion funds and assistance to people from other states who come to try and obtain an abortion in their state where it might be legal. I mean, people have been planning for this at a practical level because it's kind of been in the cards now. And, you know, people have been saying this for years, oh, we're on the verge of losing Roe. I think we really are now.
So, and also on the federal level, there are a couple of avenues. So Pelosi, whom we heard at the top, is pushing through a bill specifying reproductive rights. But what are its chances given the radical political climate we're living in?
Yeah, I don't think the chances of that are great. I mean, you know, there are probably some things that the Department of Justice can do. With the Texas law specifically, there was an interesting article by a couple of Harvard law scholars. Lawrence Tribe was one of them in the Boston Globe last week saying that, you know, the DOJ could treat this essentially bounty hunting that the law in Texas and I guess other similar laws, if they went that route, would be doing too. They could treat that kind of bounty hunting as a deprivation of civil rights, and they could investigate and punish it that way, because you're essentially protecting individual citizens who are being targeted for extrajudicial violence. So, you know, that would be something. And there may be other ways that the DOJ can try and protect people from the kind of worst excesses of some of these laws. But I think at the federal level, it's pretty difficult.
So when North Carolina passed its so-called bathroom bill, and when Georgia passed laws designed to limit voting access for people of color, private businesses canceled events there and divested themselves of investments. Are we anticipating anything like that tied to the new Texas law?
Well, interestingly, we haven't really seen it so far. There hasn't been a lot of outcry from corporations, airlines and others. The one exception that I've heard about so far is both Uber and Lyft have said that they would provide legal funds to defend any drivers of theirs who were sued under this new Texas law or similar laws in other states, because a lot of people were citing Uber and Lyft drivers as potential targets, you know, early on. So they did, in this very practical way, rally around them. But it's interesting because, as a practical matter, if you think about corporations, you know, having employees in these states, I mean, when you think about the fact that one out of five, sometimes it said, you know, women in America will have an abortion in their lifetime. You know, this is a medical service that people access pretty regularly, and that people, working women, you know, depend on the option of having to access. So, you know, I think it's something to think about in terms not only of, you know, general rights and upholding, you know, a decision that has been in effect for 50 years, but also in terms of just practical life for people working for these companies. So it'll be interesting to see if that changes and corporations do become more vocal. You know, I know there has been some criticism just of the strategy of de-investment in states, that may be harming more workers and other people in the states, and maybe that's not a great way to go. So maybe some of the abortion rights groups are not demanding it of corporations. I'm not sure about that.
And that may build over time, especially if there's a sustained public outcry. And we do know, every poll shows us that there's a strong majority of Americans who support the right to abortion. In the meantime, what can the average person do to help support the Constitution and help in the fight for access to reproductive health care?
Well, you know, I think it's good for people to just speak up about this. I think there is, you know, strangely, in some ways, a lingering embarrassment about abortion, even though it's a medical procedure, a very safe medical procedure. And even though, as you say, about 60% of Americans supported in access to it in all or some circumstances. And even though people depend on it, you know, because the fact is that, you know, accidental pregnancies have always happened. They always will happen. People have self-managed abortions or sought abortions in almost every country in the world that we know of, you know, throughout history. So, you know, this is something that people depend on, that is part of life. And yet there's this kind of stigma and embarrassment about it still, I think. So one thing is to just open up the discussion, open up the debate, be more open if you have had an abortion, if you, value the access to this important procedure. But the other is, you know, I think to speak out about these laws, to support organizations that are providing funds for women who will need to seek abortions in other states. You know, those are a couple of ideas.
Thanks so much, Margaret.
Thank you.
Margaret Talbot is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of The Entertainer, Movies, Magic, and My Father's 20th Century. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app, and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.